Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. And this week, before we even jump into things, I just want to let you all know that we have a fantastic, exciting interview with Enes Kanter. Lahav was able to get him, a Boston Celtics player, real true basketball star, but also more importantly, and this is what we spoke to him about, because I got to admit, basketball is not my forte, and I don't know. I can't speak for Lahav, but I'm going to guess you know a little more about Israeli diplomacy than the NBA. But we spoke to him more about, about his advocacy with China, with what he's doing against the regime of Erdogan in Turkey, and about Israel relations, his relationship with Israel and Jews and Hanukkah. Fascinating. We're going to get to that in a bit. But before that, Lahav, Israel is closing itself off from the world just once again, no?
Yes. Israel seems to have taken the Omicron variant more seriously than anyone else in the world, and that's it. We're shut down. If you want to visit us and you're not a citizen, reschedule.
So let me just say that this whole thing is just weird to me, because I'm not saying that we shouldn't take this seriously, and I think, of course, we should, and we have to. The country and the government should be taking steps, and of course, time is a luxury. And if we've learned anything over the last couple of years of living under this cloud of COVID, it's that you do have to move fast, because if you don't take steps immediately, you could regret not taking those steps later on. But on the other hand, if you look at the numbers, right, Israel comes into Israel every day about 30,000 Israelis. And about 3,000 to 4,000 tourists, foreigners, right? Now, those tourists bring some money with them, of course, because they spend it on the economy and the GDP. The percentage of what tourism makes of Israel's overall GDP is not that big anymore. Thankfully, Israel does really well in tech and in exports and cyber and defense, etc. But it's still an important component of the economy. If Omicron is coming into the country, it's might come from those 3,000, but it could also come from the 30,000 Israelis who are coming here. So like, by banning the 3,000, I'm not sure that you're stopping it, not to mention the fact that it's already here, right? There's a couple of cases that have already been discovered inside the country. So the whole logic there kind of escapes me in trying to understand what the government is doing. Do you have a sense of what they were trying to do?
I have more complaints, to be honest, to add to yours. I just think that we, and it's not just us, I see other countries, the US is stuck in this too, where the number that people keep looking at is how many people have COVID as opposed to how many people are severely ill. At this point, especially in Israel, we're one of the most vaccinated countries in the world. The people who are catching COVID are children. The overwhelming majority, like, you know, we're talking about like 99% of children who get COVID, probably more than 99%, are not very ill at all. If, you know, they're basically barely even sick, you know, they just stay home so that other people don't catch it. And so I just feel like, okay, the Omicron is more contagious, but is it more dangerous? Is it making people more sick? We have no indication of that. So why do we need to turn things around? So, you know, maybe better than closing the whole country, we should have actual, you know, enforcement of the existing rules of people wearing masks indoors, of not overcrowding places. You know, those things have not been enforced, or at least the enforcement has become much more lax lately. And maybe that would have been a better idea than closing the whole country down.
I agree with you. I think that's important. I think that we also need to do more to get, there's still a segment of this population that has yet to vaccinate, which just is beyond what I can understand.
Yes.
And I've tried to understand, is I find it very difficult when talking to some of these people. Like, they know better. They're not doctors, they're not scientists, but they've read some blogs or listened to Joe Rogan's podcast. So they know better now how to manage COVID than the FDA, the CDC, the Israeli Health Ministry, the scientists at Weizmann, the scientists at Pfizer, the scientists all over. Okay, they know better from doing that. So I, you know, that just escapes me to an extent. But I try to keep an open mind. So, of course, you know, we all know people who are not vaccinating, but people have the ability to vaccinate. So there is a way to move forward. And I think, you know, I was listening to an interview today with Sharon Elry Price, who's the head of public health in the Israeli Health Ministry. And she said, look, yeah, the lockdown of barring foreigners from entering the country, that's one step that we're taking. We're obviously going to evaluate that as we move forward. But the most important thing that people still can do is vaccinate. I took my two kids last week after Israel opened up, started Tuesday vaccinating 5 to 11-year-olds. My two older kids who are 14 and 18 have already been triple vaccinated. My younger two did not get any vaccines because they were under 12. And right away on Tuesday they started. I took them and got them both. They got their first shot, right? So I guess maybe I'm a believer in this stuff, but I figure that if that's what the sign says, that's what we should do. And we should be protecting ourselves, right? So so I hope that more people maybe take advantage of the situation to do that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand people being a little bit more nervous about their children, even though I, you know, my kids are too young. But in January, when my daughter is 5, I plan to take her to be vaccinated. But certainly adults who are not vaccinated, like, what are they waiting for? You know, like, unless they have like a specific medical reason, like, we're all doing okay here, you know, and the amount of breakthrough cases of people who are vaccinated, you know, triple vaccinated and getting COVID is like almost zero. So, you know, I truly don't understand it. But as far as this government is concerned, you know, it's also inconsistent in the sense that Bennett, from the get-go, from when he was, you know, in the opposition and Netanyahu was prime minister running things, and including, you know, in his first months as prime minister, his whole thing was to keep the economy as open as possible while dealing with COVID.
Right.
And this very much contradicts that. Look, we're not having a shutdown. And they are being very hesitant of shutting things down inside Israel. But a lot of this travel is important for business.
You know, Lahav, it touches upon also, forget about the business side, which I think is important. But we had a story the other day about diaspora leaders that are very upset of the fact that Jews cannot enter the country, Jews who are not citizens. We saw the chief rabbi of South Africa, Warren Goldstein, who writes occasionally also for the newspaper, who put out a very harsh statement of how Israel should allow the Jews of South Africa to enter. Right now, all of Africa is blocked from entering Israel. And it's all of Africa now is a red zone. So even Israelis can't go there if they wanted to leave the country.
All of sub-Saharan Africa, we could keep going to Morocco.
Sub-Saharan Africa.
Right.
Morocco and Egypt, of course, the two countries that we need to have good relations with, right? You know, that's like wink, wink. Of course, they don't have no corona there. But I think there is an interesting debate to be had here about the role that Israel plays as a Jewish state in the lives of Jews who don't live here. We kind of had this last year with the original lockdowns when people were not allowed into the country for a long period of time or had to apply to come and had to have first degree relatives.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm kind of torn, to be honest, right? On the one hand, I get that a country has to protect itself, right? And has to close off. On the other hand, Israel, it's not your regular run of the mill country. It plays a key role in the identity of people around the world. And I've heard Jews of, particularly in America, who have spoken very harshly about these steps that Israel has taken, even as recent as the announcement that was made Saturday night.
Yeah, I mean, people definitely are taking it badly. People are very upset. But I agree with you. I am of two minds about it, because on the one hand, you know, we are the Jewish homeland and we need to be open for all Jews. On the other hand, you know, as a country, we need to protect our citizens. So in this case, I think that it was a mistake in general to close the country to foreigners. And that includes members of the Jewish diaspora. But I think, you know, if there's a refugee issue, if there are Jews who are in trouble and need to come to Israel, they can still come. The fact is that the government just approved 3,000 people to come from Ethiopia, right. which is an entirely different, complicated issue that I don't want to get into. But like, certainly if there was something going on in South Africa where South African Jews felt they had to escape to Israel, they could come. And people who were making Aliyah were allowed to make Aliyah all along.
Right.
And so I think that the accusation is a little bit unfair, because they're saying, let us be tourists. You know, I get there's also, you know, the religious element. Let us pray at the Kotel or in Hebron or wherever they want to go. But for the most part, what they're saying is let us be the special tourists who can come. And, you know, because Israel still is open as the Jewish homeland to these people, but they don't want it to be there. These aren't necessarily people who are looking to come home here. They're looking to you know, visit on their winter vacation.
No, I think it's complicated. I hear the frustration and the disappointment. I also totally understand, of course, you know, you got to take care of your country and your people before worrying about the religious or Jewish identity of people around the world. But I do think that it needs to be done smartly. It needs to be, it has to be more sensitive, maybe. It has to be explained better. And that's an issue that the government has to address, right? It can't just, you know, maybe the solution is they can't just shut down, say no one can come in anymore without explaining, without reaching out to people, without sending a message. I don't know, but you know, it could be something like that. The other thing that's interesting is that we have the Big Brother is back watching, right? The Shabak is back in our phones. They're tracking us once again.
Yeah.
Are they listening to this conversation, do you think?
Maybe. Well, at the moment, it's only back tracking people who have the Omicron variant. So it's a very small number of people. That being said, I sort of think that the Shabak could track my phone at any time if they wanted to. I mean,
and maybe they, I work off the assumption that we're being listened to all the time as journalists by somebody,
yes,
whether it's China, Russia, Iran, or the Shabak.
I think I've talked to you about this in the past, that I've gotten notifications from Google that state actors are trying to get into my email. So right. I very much work on that assumption. But leaving that aside, let's talk about the Shabak. So they're following now the people who have the Omicron variant. It's part of the new COVID rules that if you are, you know, found positive for that variant, you have to let them track your phone. They will track your phone. But I think what's politically interesting here is that Health Minister Nitzan Horowitz was a huge opponent of this. And he, you know, said it was undemocratic to have the Shabak tracking phones when he wasn't in government. Now that he's in government, he approved this. And his justification is that it's very narrow and limited, which, I mean, it's true. It is. But it's interesting. He felt very strongly about it. And then in the cabinet meeting where they authorized this, Eli Avidar, a minister who's from Yisrael Beiteinu, but not of Yisrael Beiteinu, I would say, in that he's rebelling right against his party. He doesn't get along with the party leader, Avigdor Lieberman. He was a huge, like, anti-Netanyahu protester while he was a Knesset member. He would go to all the protests, and he was against a lot of the COVID stuff, against a lot of the lockdowns, and also against a lot of the measures to convince people to get vaccines. Although he himself is vaccinated, but he took a while. I think he took a few months till he agreed to actually do it. Mm-hmm. In any case, he got into a screaming match with Bennett.
Right.
He said to, in the cabinet meeting, he said to the head of the Shabak, like, I think you've fallen in love with spying on Israelis, something along those lines. And then Bennett yelled at him. He said to him, Lama Miata, which is like the most, I know it's, hey, who are you? But it's also like for Israelis, right, it's like a very, I don't know. It's like, yeah, like
degrading,
right. It's a very degrading comment. Yeah. Like, please, like, who are you to even talk?
But I think what's interesting here is that there are parts of this government that were really opposed to the use of the Shabak in the previous iterations of the lockdowns that Israel had back when Netanyahu was prime minister. And now they're doing it. I mean, very out of left field, but there was this appointment of Amir Peretz, the former defense minister, right, who they wanted to make the chairman of Israel Aerospace Industry, big government-owned defense company. There was a vetting committee that said that he's not qualified, and the government decided to push through the appointment anyhow, which is something that had Yair Lapid been in the opposition and Bibi would have done that, Lapid would have gone crazy. Right now that Lapid's in the government,
it's not just Lapid though. That's the thing. The inconsistency is not just Lapid. It's also Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit, because in the last government, Dudi Amsalem, who was a minister of like some made up, it was like the digitization ministry, but it was like basically made up to give him a job. In any case,
I was sleeping quietly at night knowing that he was in that role.
Right.
I mean, you just like shattered this illusion of security that I had with Dudi Amsalem
being the digital minister. Okay. Yeah. Yes. In any case, he wanted to appoint someone to a job without going through the whole process of the committee, and Mandelblit put his foot down. And in this case, Mandelblit mm-hmm. didn't put his foot down. Now, I mean, I've seen and I've been listening to the radio people arguing about this, that the argument is that Amir Peretz is eminently qualified. The job is to be the chairman of the Israel Aerospace
Industries. Yeah, yes. IAI.
Right. So you know, he's a former defense minister, and he also was the head of Israel's biggest labor union. So he has management experience and defense experience. And so people were saying, even if the committee rejected him, he actually is experienced and should have the job. So maybe that's how Mandelblit explains it.
But you have gatekeepers for a reason.
Exactly.
And you can't, you know.
And it just seems very political. Like, this is what bothers me about Mandelblit specifically. Like, he is not supposed to be political. He's supposed to be neutral. We're supposed to trust him that the reason he's prosecuting the prime minister, for example, is because of rule of law and not because of political preferences. And then he does this, which I'm not saying that it actually reflects on the Netanyahu thing, but it's disconcerting.
I just think, again, I mean, you know, there's a lot of pieces to this puzzle, but there's the famous Ariel Sharon line, right? Mashro'im mikan, lo ro'im misham, or the other way around. But what you see from here, you didn't see from there. So once I'm in power or in office, I see things a little differently than when I was not in power or in office. And I think that that's what Lapid is seeing. I think that's what Merav Micheli from Labor, Nitzan Horowitz from Meretz, and obviously Bennett as the prime minister. Things are different when you're the guy or the woman who's making the decision, right? And that pertains to Peretz, that pertains to using the Shabak to track Israeli citizens. And that just has to do with a lot of things. But before we go, Lahav, and just introduce our guests, this is also a big week on Iran, right? We're talking just as the Iranians are sitting down for negotiations with the P4 plus one, I guess you could call it that, because the Americans are not around that table. It used to be the P5 plus one. But Israel is not happy, right? What's the latest that you're hearing from the prime minister's office?
Bennett is taking a turn for the Bibi. He is coming out guns blazing, so it is figurative, rhetorical guns blazing, to speak out against what's going on now. You know, he just, as we're speaking now, he just released comments where he said that the world should not be giving in to Iran's nuclear blackmail, that if the world negotiates on Iran's terms, and then, this is an exact quote, Iran won't just keep its nuclear program, they'll be getting paid for it. Israel's concern, like, Iran is coming into these negotiations saying, we are not negotiating about nuclear. We are only negotiating the lifting of sanctions, right? Now, we all know the JCPOA had two elements. One element is the gradual lifting of sanctions. And the other element is that Iran would limit its nuclear program for a certain amount of time.
Right.
And Israel said it wasn't enough time. It wasn't enough limitations. But either way, these negotiations were supposed to be to return to that deal. And now, because Iran is, first of all, has gone so far beyond the restrictions of the 2015 deal, but also because Iran says they don't even want to talk about nuclear, some of the American side is talking about what they call less for less. But some of the people at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies have been calling it less for more, or more for less. I don't remember which direction. Basically, in exchange for freezing its nuclear program, not rolling it back, just stopping where they are at 60% enrichment, which is very high. Mm-hmm. You need 90% for a bomb. The U.S. would lift sanctions. And so the reason that, you know, the FDD calls it more for less and not less for less is less sanctions actually means more money for Iran.
Right.
So they would just get a lot of money, which Israel's concerned that it would then, you know, not just concerned, I mean, it's based on experience. They would then use it to fund all their proxies, to fund Hamas, to fund Hezbollah, you know, and terrorism against Saudi Arabia and the civil war in Yemen, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, their nuclear program will just be on hold for them to restart whenever they're, like, mad at the Americans or decide they don't like this agreement anymore, you know. And it's a real nightmare scenario for Israel. And so Bennett was being a little bit quieter the first few months. You know, he spoke about Iran, but he wasn't speaking as much, I would say, about what the West is doing in terms of Iran. And now he's really, I think, openly coming out and saying, you are making a mistake. And Lapid also is in London today, the day we're speaking. He's going to be in Paris tomorrow. Like, both of those trips will be behind him by the time this podcast comes out.
Right.
But in London today, he said, you know, the world needs to come into these negotiations from a position of strength, implying that they are coming in a position of weakness right now.
I think what we know, though, is that the world is coming into these talks from a position of, let's get a deal and let's get out of here. Right.
Right.
And that's what the world world wants, and that kind of conflicts with Israel's interest. Obviously, Israel wants a tougher deal, stronger, longer, all those different terms. But it's probably not going to get it. And then the question that Israel will have to deal with is very similar to the question that Netanyahu had to deal with after the 2015 deal of what do you do now? So Bennett has said already, well, we're going to keep on preparing a military option and we won't be bound by the deal. But if there is a deal, I would venture to say that Israel's hands are going to be tied for some time, right? Because to see Israeli action when a deal is in place that the world is happy about would mean Israeli action with zero or even a minus of international legitimacy. And of course, Israel should always do what's in its best interest to safeguard its country and the nation and its people. But that might not be going against the entire world and turning the entire world against itself. So it's a complicated scenario,
and I don't know.
We'll have to see what comes out of Vienna. Of course, you'll be following it. Lahav, you were able to get for us Enes Kanter. So that was like super cool to talk to a basketball star. Not something that I get to do every day or you get to do every day.
Isn't it funny, though, how like I talk to like Naftali Bennett, the prime minister, and I used to talk to Netanyahu. But it's like Enes Kanter. Wow, that's so cool. And you're not the only person who reacted that way.
Because that is cool. Because it's different. Because it's different. Exactly. Let's also be a little honest here. I think he probably has more followers.
That's for sure.
Social media channels than Naftali Bennett does at the moment. But of course, you know, what's unique is going to be a little cooler. And Enes Kanter, we speak to him about advocacy against China, talking out against King LeBron James about the his shoes, right? He's been attacking him for, and Erdogan in Turkey jailing of journalists, and also a message of coexistence. He's a Muslim, and what he sends to the Jewish people. And then you have an interview with MK Sharon Haskell from New Hope, where she spoke about Lahav.
Well, she talked to us about, first of all, what it's like being in this very, very diverse coalition. But she also has, I think, very different and interesting political positions. You know, she's very economically liberal and maybe even borderline libertarian in a way you don't see a lot in Israel. And she's also been advocating for legalizing cannabis.
Marijuana.
Yes. Right. And also, interestingly, poker, which technically... It's an illegal gray zone in Israel.
And gamble at the same time.
Right.
So now we have to open the country. We have to open the country to people. This is the place you want to be. Stay with us. Coming up now, interview with Enes Kanter and then MK Sharon Haskell. Here we go.
All right, we have a very special guest on this episode, Enes Kanter, NBA basketball player on the Boston Celtics, who has made a lot of waves lately for his political views and his political activism on human rights issues and especially on the issue of China. And also this week is becoming a U.S. citizen. So welcome to our show at this exciting time for you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate that.
So I read today that you are changing your last name to Freedom, that your name's going to be Enes Kanter Freedom. Is that true? And why are you doing that?
Yes, it is true, actually. Well, I'm going to become a citizen tomorrow, so I will be officially and legally changing my last name tomorrow. Someone leaked the news already, so it's out there. But I think, you know, the one thing about freedom, you know, in America, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't have any freedom. I didn't have, you know, if you look at where I grew up in Turkey, there is no freedom of speech, religion, or expression. And well, when I come to America, America gave me all of it. And I think that freedom is one of the most greatest things that a human being can have. And that's what I have been fighting for my whole life, freedom, and to also feed for not just my freedom, but people's freedom. So to me, it was very important to, you know, just make that word something very special and a part of me. So that's why I you know, added a word freedom in my last name.
Well, Enes, you know, it comes at an interesting time for us in Israel and for the Jewish people worldwide who are celebrating this week the holiday of Hanukkah, which is essentially a holiday that marks freedom of the Jewish people. It marks, you know, a few thousand years ago, the victory and the reestablishment of Jewish Renaissance and control and sovereignty in the land of Israel, but also of the defeat of light over darkness. And I'm curious if that's a message that you also carry with you.
I mean, for Hanukkah, first of all, I want to wish all my Jewish brothers and sisters a very, very happy Hanukkah. You know, in a couple of days, you know, to the Jewish people celebrate a miracle where one day's worth of oil, I believe, provided light of 8 full days.
Right.
And this is why the light, the menorah for 8 days. And I just want to say, you know, let us celebrate the next 8 days with happiness, peace, and love for one another, regardless of religion. And, you know, I want to say no one should ever have to feel unsafe to practice their religion, especially, you know, in their own home. If you remember, you know, 2 years ago on the 7th night of the Hanukkah, the home of the rabbi was invaded. You know,
yeah.
A masked man attacked and stabbed the guests of a Hanukkah party. 5 people were hurt in the attack. You know, this violence towards one another definitely needs to stop. And we need to learn how to coexist with one another. And not only should we coexist, but we should love and respect one another regardless of religion. So there's so much we can all learn from one another. And I'm grateful to have learned so much about other religions through my time here.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about people should not have to hide or be afraid because of their religion. And I know that you have learned from the cleric Fethullah Gulen, who Erdogan considers an enemy. And I guess how did that experience sort of inspire you to be so proactive about human rights and freedom?
You know, I have been going to, you know, Gulen school since the second grade, and those schools were the best schools in Turkey, and those schools were the reason that I am so open to, you know, dialogue. I'm so open to other religions and cultures and other people, because in those schools, they taught me so much about how to open your heart to other people. And, you know, when I first met with Mr. Gulen, he told me one thing that really inspired me. He said, it doesn't matter what your religion is, your culture, your skin color, or whatever you are. The most important thing in life is leave your differences on the table and try and find what we have in common. So that literally like inspired me so much. And every time, you know, I go visit him, he always talks about what can we do for others, not just for our Muslim brothers and sisters, but other people from different religions and cultures. So that's why the reason why I am today is because of those schools. So that definitely inspired me.
You know, but Ennis, it's interesting. You're unique. I mean, not only are you a great ball player, and, you know, that's why you've been so successful, but you're also unique in your such a vocal stand that you take on issues of human rights, right? You, at least in the NBA, I can't think of someone who has been so outspoken on China, on other violations of human rights, on coexistence. It's something that's remarkable, and I'm curious, where does it come from, and are you not afraid that you're going to pay a price for it, that this could even, you could pay a professional price, an economic price. Sponsors won't want to endorse you. Companies won't want you to advertise. You're going to become too controversial. What do you say about that?
Nike specifically.
Right.
I mean, I'll just start with this. Someone had to do it. You know, you see, there's so many, you know, actors, you know, just recently, like, you know, John Cena, so many athletes, so many, you know, rappers, singers, or people who has platform are scared of to talk about what's really going on. You know, to me, you know, to be the weak people's voice, to me, you know, to be the innocent people's voice, to me, you know, the standing up for human rights, freedom and democracy is more important than first myself, more important than sports, basketball, and NBA, you know, because I believe if they were in my shoes, they will do the same thing. You know, those innocent people, you know, I cannot go to sleep at night in peace, where I know my Muslim brothers and sisters are in China in genocide right now, where they're getting tortured and raped every day. And not just my Muslim brothers and sisters, but, you know, the violations, you know, human rights violations are happening all over the world. So I cannot go to sleep in peace at night knowing that I'm not doing enough, because I believe that this platform is giving me by God, and God, this is God's work. And I'm trying to do my best to, you know, spread this message and to be the voice of all those innocent people out there who don't have a voice, you know? And so if I say something, you know, something wrong, I'm going to call out. It doesn't matter if you're the NBA, if you're Nike, whoever.
Right. Also the Olympics. And I saw that you know, you've been calling out now for the Olympics to be canceled in China in 2022, but also this, the Winter Olympics, obviously, but you've also been in countries, I think it was Indonesia, and you had to really flee almost when it seemed like people were coming for you, right? So this is actually, it's not just money anymore. It's even your outspokenness and your activism has put you in some danger to an extent, right?
You know, we are getting death threats probably 2 or 3 times a week. And especially like whenever I'm in, you know, America, I'm protected by FBI all the time. And, you know, the important, you know, I remember, I was staying in a house. They told me it's not safe. They told me to move to a hotel room. So I moved to a hotel room. And when I was in a road game, the FBI came to my hotel room, and they set up this thing called panic button. They said, whenever you feel uncomfortable, push that button. We'll be there in 2 or 3 minutes. I mean, obviously there's so many threats out there. There's so many people who doesn't like when I call them out, because it's the truth. Because, you know, especially like countries like China and stuff, they buy people, they buy silence with money. So to me, it was important, you know, because I never chased money my whole life. You know, I was always trying to do the right thing. But, you know, obviously, whenever we talk about this issue, it's going to come up with great danger. So you got to do everything you can to just protect yourself.
So one person in particular who was not happy to be called out was LeBron James, who's the, you know, quote unquote king of the NBA. How did that sort of feel for you? Do you feel like that puts you in a difficult position? And maybe you could tell us a little bit about these shoes that you've been wearing and where that idea came from.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you're an NBA player, especially what I was trying to do is inspire a young generation out there, because, you know, when I was young, I was always like, the first thing I looked was the what shoes that NBA players are wearing. So right now, all the kids in the world are just watching what the NBA players are wearing. So to me, and the most important item on a basketball player is the shoes. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to create the most influential shoes that have ever created in history, you know, because to me, it was so important to stand up for the things and also at the same time, educate the young generation. You know, obviously I have been, you know, creating the shoes, and the response that I get from people, it's amazing. So to me, that was really important. So about the LeBron thing, obviously, you know, you need to call out these athletes when, you know, they have huge platform, but it was really sad when these uneducated athletes are signing these huge deals with these, you know, hypocrite companies like Nike, where they're not doing no background check. How Nike is using slave laborers and sweatshops over there in China and abusing people. So like to me, it was important to call out these, you know, players like Michael Jordan and LeBron James, because those people are making millions and maybe billions of dollars from Nike, and Nike using slave laborers over there in China and using little kids, you know? So right. I mean, obviously, a lot of these athletes, they're not gonna like it a lot, because I mean, you're pretty much doing it in front of the whole world. But you know what? It is what it is.
And it's, you know, Israel has its own issues with Turkey, in particular. I'm sure you've seen in the press of Erdogan with some very strong anti-Semitic comments over the years against Israel. You know, we know also, I speak as a journalist, we know that there's close to 300 journalists, 150 journalists about, who have been jailed in recent years in Turkey. They're number 2 in the world in the imprisonment of reporters. You mentioned earlier how in Turkey there is not freedom of speech. What advice would you have, if any, for Israel and how to deal with the situation in Turkey? And I'll just remind, you know, it was just a week or two ago when an Israeli couple on a tourism trip in Turkey, and I'm sure you saw these reports, was arrested because they had taken a photo of Erdogan's house in Istanbul, an innocent tourism picture, and they were immediately accused of being spies. Thankfully, Israel was able to get them released. But Turkey, is it a safe country for Israelis, do you think?
So let me just tell you this. What breaks my heart is there's so many young generation are growing up in Turkey, anti-Semitic and anti-West. Because what Erdogan is doing is whenever he holds a rally, he attacks one America and he attacks Israel. Because, and then people, you know, see this and they grown up as anti-Semitic and anti-Israel and anti-America, anti-West. You know, this is unacceptable. You know, I have so many Jewish friends in America and they're one of the most nicest people that I know, you know? So like, to me, that breaks my heart. You know, kids are growing up hating Israel, hating Jewish people, hating, you know, burning Israeli flags. And that is all Erdogan's fault. The second thing is that, I mean, first of all, the number is 365. It's the top three country in the world put the most drones in a jail. That shows that there is no freedom of speech, you know. And when I heard about that, a couple, you know, took a picture of Erdogan's house and they were in jail for a while, it just showed one more time to the whole world that what Erdogan is doing. Think about what Erdogan is doing, you know, to other, you know, citizens around the world, and then think about what Erdogan is doing behind the curtains to his own people. So people need to understand this, you know. But to me, I hope that someone, the, you know, United Nations, America, or European Union will do something, because they are playing the nice game with a dictator, and you cannot do that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a chance that some think there will be one day a change in the power in Turkey?
Well, I mean, I don't really expect, and so there's an election in 2023, and I don't really expect anything from it, because obviously Erdogan is going to do something, steal the elections and, you know, steal the votes. He's going to do something to, you know, just become a president again. But I think, you know, what we need is more strong voices to just come out and, you know, say something against Erdogan. Unfortunately, there's not one, you know, celebrity, one athlete, or anyone that's talking against, you know, the Turkish government, because they're too scared of their business. They care about too much about money. They care about too much about their career. So they care their morals, and they care money over morals and principles and values.
Do you feel like that the NBA or the owner of the Celtics, et cetera, like, has your back when it comes to your ability to speak freely about all of these issues?
When it comes to Turkey, yes. Obviously, you know, they supported me 100%. But when it comes to, you know, obviously things like China, there's so much, you know, millions of dollars are involved, and there's so many business that NBA is doing with China and stuff. So they're not obviously as supportive as like the Turkey. You know, I talk about Turkey 10 years. I did not get one phone call, one complaint, but I talk about, you know, China one day, my phone was ringing once every 2 hours. So, but I think the important thing is, it doesn't matter what kind of business that you're doing with who, they're just standing up for innocent people, you know? So like, right. NBA also called himself a social justice organization. But they need to stand up for things, not just in America, but all over the world.
So, Enes, as we wrap up, I'm curious, you know, there's probably a lot of young people who look up to you. You're a great ball player, playing for the Celtics. You've been playing with other teams as well, in a career that's already over more than a decade. What do you tell kids who you meet? And I know you run camps as well to train young people as they in basketball, but I'm sure they're getting more than just, you know, how to shoot a basket or how to pick up a rebound. What other message do you tell them?
You know, my message to all this new young generation out there, live for others. You know, do we rise by lifting others. So it's important to whatever you're doing. You don't have to be an NBA player. Whatever you're doing, use those ability to, you know, to be the voice of innocent people out there. To use those ability to help people, lift others. You know, that is my one message. And then the second thing is respect. You know, like what I learned from Mr. Gulen, you know, it doesn't matter what your religion is. You're Muslim, you're Jewish, you're Catholic, you're Christian, whatever you are. Important thing is just, you know, the respect others' religions and cultures. Like, especially, you know, I sit down with so many of my Jewish brothers and sisters in America. It's like everything almost the same. The food we eat, you know, they eat kosher, we eat halal, or the dances, or the music, everything is so similar. When you look at a person, you have to see human first, and then other thing comes. So to me, the respect, you know, is really, really important. Try to bring love and peace and compassion into this world.
Amazing.
Well, it's really great to hear someone who's using his prominence in such a positive way and really just willing to speak out for the downtrodden. So really, we have so much respect for what you're doing. And we want to thank you for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, man. And also, happy Hanukkah, man.
Hanukkah. Thank you.
Happy Hanukkah. Really thank you. Guys. This week on the podcast, we have Knesset member Sharren Haskel of the New Hope Party, formerly of Likud, and is now a member of this coalition, which Yaakov, my co-host, likes to call the Kaleidoscope Coalition, where we have all the different colors combined. Sharren, what is it like? You know, most of your years in politics, you were in a pretty homogeneous political coalition, and now you have a lot of you have more of a balancing act. What is that like?
It's not easy. I mean, the current coalition is not easy in the sense that you have so many. First of all, it's a huge number of parties. I mean, we're talking about 8 parties now. Those 8 parties are on a spectrum from right to left, from secular to religious. So it's very, very complicated. And you need to come to many compromises. You need to understand that, a lot of the things that you want to promote and push, as reforms or legislations, are not going to happen as you want them to happen. And many of the issues that are very important to our other members of the coalition, they're not going to happen either. And we need to find sort of the mutual ground on what we can cooperate together. So economy, health, education, and many more. With those challenges, though, come also a great opportunity. Because, you know, I was a member of Knesset in the 20th Knesset, and that was a very challenging Knesset and coalition as well. We were, most of us, from the right-wing spectrum as parties, but on many issues like the economy, we didn't agree, definitely not on religious issues. Just to remind you that we had 2 ultra-Orthodox parties within this coalition that also blocked many legislations that I wanted to promote as well. And that was challenging as well. So I try to see the opportunities in this current coalition and the things that we can advance in the country that was sort of on hold for many, many years
now. You know, you mentioned economic issues, and you, when you were in the Likud, and I think you and some of the other people who moved to New Hope were identified with the more liberal side of Likud and with sort of a free market economic stance, which, I mean, you continue to be, and yet you're with the Labour Party and Meretz. So it's an interesting point that I don't think has maybe come up so much politically, but how are you advancing those goals in this coalition?
Absolutely. I mean, I was quite worried about that aspect. I mean, on an economic level, I would be called an extreme right And yes, I believe in a free market, in reducing taxes, in reducing regulations and bureaucracy. It's part of the issues that I was voted into the Knesset in order to promote.
And it must be said, like, you do have the prime minister on that side as well in this case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I have great partners at the moment in order to do that. I mean, the budget that we've passed is a very liberal, it's very right-leaning type of budget, where we've passed reforms that Netanyahu, that was considered a very right-wing economical person, was too afraid to do. And in that sense, that was to my surprise, that with Labour and with those left-wing parties, we were able to pass a very right-wing budget that reduces an enormous amount of regulation, that cut taxes, that you know, I'll give maybe even some examples so that maybe people understand more. So, for example, opening up importation. Okay, there were heavy regulations on things that were imported into Israel. For example, on food. Okay, just 3 days ago, we eliminated the taxes on butter. And, you know, in Israel, we had...
There were price controls.
Yeah, it was price control, but also amount controlled by the government, the amount that was allowed to be produced here in Israel, right. Which is, I mean, it belongs, like, you know, to Soviet times, if I must say. And everybody was so afraid of eliminating it. And here, Lieberman and Oded Forer, the Treasury Minister and the Minister of
Agriculture
actually did this amazing move, and the result would be a lower price of butter for the citizens of Israel, and you know what? Sometimes even a better quality. There's a reason why we prefer sometimes European butter than Israeli butter as well. So that's one example. Another example is there's many examples to that. If you want, I can speak a bit more about it. But
well, I think it's interesting because on the one hand, there is some deregulation. On the other hand, I felt like there were some policies that were sort of using taxes to try to change behaviors, which in American politics, people might call it the nanny state, like the tax on single use, you know, plasticware, and tax on sugary drinks and things like that. Did you support that?
No, I mean, you know, I'm obliged to many of the reforms that the government decides on them, including many of them. And sometimes, you know, I feel uncomfortable and I disagree with them. I don't think that it's our job to educate the citizens on how to act. I believe in, you know, a private initiatives. And I believe that people in Israel are good and they want to do good. And that's what they'll do. But I have to say, yes, there were some of these reforms in this budget. But you know what? In the 20th Knesset under Netanyahu, there were the same legislation that passed. For example, marking all food that is with high sugar or high fat. For example, the taxes that they've added into cigarettes. So time after time, we see all governments trying to dictate and educate the citizens. Some I agree more and some I agree less. Specifically on these issues, I didn't agree with it before and I don't agree with it now.
So one of the areas in which you want Israel to be freer is when it comes to the use of cannabis, that you want to decriminalize or further decriminalize, legalize it. And I know you recently took a big stand on that issue, and the coalition, you know, you wouldn't vote with the coalition because of it. So could you tell us a little bit, first of all, where things stand sort of when it comes to those laws and where you want them to go?
So I believe that Israel should legalize marijuana. I think that the more the government is closing its eyes, the more criminal families and crime is being funded from the basic fact that it is illegal. We have a huge crisis at the moment, with violence within the Arab sector here in Israel. Now, this goes back to a negligence of more than a decade of not enforcing the law in Israel, in not deterring people who commit crimes. And it came down to what we see today, where almost every day there's someone that's being murdered or a heavy crime that's being committed. We see protections, taxes. How do you call them? Do you call it?
It's called protection. Yeah, like in the mafia, you pay exactly. Protection.
And
yeah.
You see that happening in major cities like Beersheba, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and up in the north of Israel. And unfortunately, because of that negligence and not dealing with the issues, those crime organizations are flourishing here in Israel and are gaining a huge amount of money. A lot of it is being subsidized from selling cannabis, from importing illegally cannabis through the borders. And, you know, once we are legalizing it, once there are specific, shops where you can go and, for example, buy, when it's all regulated by the government, then you see that black market starting to shrink. You see, billions of dollars that are being used today in crime organizations from it will completely disappear. Another interesting factor that we've seen in Canada as well is that once mm-hmm. they passed legalization of cannabis, you saw a drop in the use of cannabis among teenagers, which is amazing. So I obviously support and I push. I've been fighting for the past 6 years. To legalize, decriminalize, and to reform the medical cannabis. There is a vast majority for it, but unfortunately, time after time, because of power struggle and coalition opposition wars, this issue is not being passed. So in former Knessets, I know that there was a majority for it. Matter of fact, in the 23rd Knesset, the ultra-Orthodox opposed my legislation, but I persuade Yesh Atid to support this bill from the opposition, and this is how I was able to pass it. So same today. Unfortunately, Ra'am, one of the parties that are members of this coalition are opposing these legislations. But time after time, Netanyahu and members of the Likud party, and they still say it today, are supportive of these reforms. And it means that the same way that I did in the 23rd Knesset by persuading Yesh Atid party to support from the opposition, this is probably the same road that I'll have to take this time as well. And once I find four fingers in the opposition, I will be willing and brave enough to put those wars aside and do what's right for our country and for our people, and to really stand behind their election promises, then we'll be able to pass it as well.
Do you think that there's a good chance of that? I mean, the atmosphere right now is so ugly, and the Likud is so mad at the opposition, but also very mad at your party leader, Gideon Saar. Do you think any of them would be willing to cross that line?
It might take a little bit more time, but I believe we'll be able to do it.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then I read that you also want to legalize gambling or some form of gambling in Israel, which is interesting.
No. Okay.
No? Okay.
No. What I do support in the bill that I have put through is to allow tournaments of poker here in Israel. Now, it's not allowing gambling. Poker and poker tournaments are considered a sport in almost every Western country. There are leagues, there are world championships. It's considered a, how do you call it, like a luxury sport for the high society, similar to tennis and snooker or pool and sports like that. Now, in Israel, we have probably one of the bigger rates of poker champions here in Israel per citizens. There are many Israelis who compete and who championed and won positions at the World Poker Series. You know, and when they come here to Israel, they're not allowed to have those tournaments. Now, the poker league here in Israel is actually practicing in Romania. So all of the champions and all of the people who play and are, you know, considered sportsmen all around the world need to run off to Romania in order to play in or to compete in that tournament, in the Israeli tournament, which is absolutely ridiculous. I have to say one more thing about it. Mm-hmm. Israel consider gambling illegal. Okay. Now, when you gamble and you win a prize, because we have here like the lottery and gambling on sport here.
Slot machines.
Yeah. And it's run by the government. But when you do win a gambling, how do you call it exactly? It's like a game of chance. Mm-hmm. And the government tax you usually between 20% and 30%. Okay. Now, poker here in Israel is considered by law a game of chance. It means that the government, if it taxes you for winning a prize, should tax you between 20% and 30%.
I would argue that poker is a skill.
But that's the thing. Poker is a skill. And because we had a numerous amount of champions here in Israel, where some of the prizes were $8 million, the taxation office here in Israel were very greedy and wanted part of that prize. And so they put a lawsuit in the working court here in Israel, claiming that it's not a game of luck, but it's a game of skills. And it's equivalent to a sort of, how do I say, would I say it in English, like a working kind, like a job, you know? So you go and you practice, and it's considered a very sophisticated skill in probability and math, and that you have to practice and everything. Like, they proved in court that it is actually a game of skills like any other sport. And therefore, the court concluded that they can take the winning money of those sportsmen as they would do from a working Israeli that works, let's say, in high tech in the United States. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the court says that it's a game of skills. The world have acknowledged it as a game of skills. The tax office here in Israel tax them as if they are working as sportsmen, but it still will not allow them to practice here. And this is what I want to change and what I want to correct. I want the poker league here in Israel to be able to have a tournament, a national tournament, even bring here the world championship, so that, you know, we'll bring poker players from all around the world to come and compete here in Israel. It will be good for tourism. It will be good for the country.
So there's an interesting contrast, I think, in you being the Knesset member who's standing up for people who smoke cannabis and people who play poker. When I think New Hope is very much seen as the strong, like, rule of law party. Not that you're telling people to do something illegal, but I think that these things are perceived as vices.
I always enjoyed taking, you know, rightful struggles that many politicians try to run away from them. And so everybody are sort of turning a blind eye to problems that happens here in Israel. And, you know what, I don't care about how it's being sort of presented. I know that's the right thing to do, and so I go by it.
So, I wanted to ask you just about New Hope was almost just founded as a party against former Prime Minister Netanyahu. I mean, I your party leader and yourself are ideologically right wing. I'm not denying that, but it was founded to break off from Likud, which you had felt it had been corrupted by Netanyahu, and that Netanyahu himself is corrupt. I want to hear your position, I guess, on some of these new laws that are, you know, bringing in term limits, limiting who can be chosen to be prime minister. It does seem to run sort of counter to your view of sort of as much freedom as possible.
So at the end of the day, there are quite a few changes between New Hope and between the Likud party. Most of us who came from the Likud recognize the major issue, which is that instead that the party and also the members within the party works for an ideology, for an idea that we believe is right, it turns into working for a person or to preserve the seat of a person. And for us, that created a very bad politics. We want to continue and promote and defend and create a thriving Israel, a country and people. For the past 2 years, there's been a political freeze because of election, one election after the other, because of a freeze in the budget. The country was running without a budget. It created huge challenges within communities, municipalities, the education system, the health system. And so it's important to note that that is the major difference, that we work for the idea, we work for what we believe in, and not for a person.
Knesset member Sharren Haskel of the New Hope Party, thank you so much for being on the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. Great to have you with us. Please share widely with all your friends. We're on all the different platforms, and we'll see you next week.